Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 12, delivered on February 23, 2012. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. Now, some of what I'm going to say here I have said before, and this is the first of a pair of lectures that introduces the concept of risk. And I will get more specific about risk as this lecture goes on, as the next lecture goes on, and then in subsequent lectures, you'll see more about risk. But this is the first pass, and it's, and as I said, some of this I've talked to you about before. I'm trying. Madam, do you know when you're going to die? You know? Well, hell, you're no fun anymore. Do you have any idea?
Nope.
Well, you, fine. You know when you're going to die, don't you?
I do not.
You don't. I'll tell you, if you try to date my daughter, you'll know exactly when. Okay, you look like you know all about death. That dark expression, evil queen of the universe. Talk to me. When are you going to die?
Hopefully when I'm old.
Okay, well, see, that sucks because that means that you'll probably die after I do, and that just pisses me off. But you don't know exactly. But you do have a time frame. Sometime in the next, let's say, 100 years. Would that be reasonable? Okay. So we have a time frame, but you don't know the hour of your death. You could live to be an old crone. You know, real wrinkled and, you know, bitchy and all that. Or you could die tomorrow, young and pretty. You'll look damn good in your casket. You look like a risk taker. Okay? Here's a rule, though. If you're going to be a risk taker, you should not have a death where recovering your remains involves a hose, a shop vac, or a spatula. Okay? Avoid that, no matter how risky you want to live your life. The point here being that your very lives are a risk. The length of your life, every time you walk out your door, your life is in danger. You could walk out your door and a train could hit you. Bah, bah, ding, 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 ding. You say, wait a minute, there's not even a train near my tracks. Well, imagine, it jumps its tracks and it goes, you know, like that Denzel Washington movie and all that kind of. What I'm getting to here is that your lives themselves are full of risk. Every time you drive a car, every time you eat a meal at these facilities here, indeed. Beyond that, though, in your business lives, you're taking a risk by being in this college. You know that this college does not guarantee you a degree. You have to do some of that work, legwork yourself. There is no guarantee that you'll get a job just because you've got a college degree. Okay, now, in that measure, we're talking about risk in this very general, broad, visceral sense. Life is full of risk. I'm going to die someday, and all of that. In finance, we need to have a little bit more of a specificity to what we mean by risk. As a general rule, the first word that I would put that's a little more specific on risk is the word volatility. Volatility. Now, not just up and down. It has to have an unpredictable component to it. Volatility has to have a randomness, something that cannot be predicted. Because if we could predict it, then it wouldn't be risk anymore. So when we talk about volatility, we are giving sort of a little bit more of a descriptive idea of risk that we might be able to measure, the ups and downs. Now, one of the first of our measures of volatility, one of our first, and there we'll have various more and more refined measures as we go along here. But one of the first, well, I don't need that on. Why did I turn it on? So, for example, if I draw a timeline, T on the horizontal axis, and I've got price of a stock on the vertical axis, going up and down, that would be volatility, the up and down, a randomness. Now, notwithstanding these gurus that sell these packages and talk on television, there is a component of volatility in a stock price that is not predictable. You can't forecast the future. Don't let anyone tell you that you can. You just can't. There's no secret, magical, hidden truth that you use the right program or the right stock analysis newsletter and you'll find out what the price of something will be tomorrow. It ain't going to happen. So here we go. This is a sort of a measure of volatility. Now let's get a little more specific yet. Let's take a story of a company and its revenue. Just as a basic line of revenues. Now, I'm going to say that suppose that I break the future into five different possibilities. And in the middle possibility, sales would be $50,000. Okay? And this is sales next year. Now, there is our states of the economy where it could be a little better and sales would be 60,000. It could be a lot better, 70,000. And I could say, okay, on this side, this is a good economy, and this is the best economy. And then I could have down here, it could be 40,000, or it could be 30,000. And the 30,000 would be this sucks. This is blah. And on the good side, we had the good. And then we have, oh, it's a little up. We'll just say meh. And then best. Is that like, or am I, you know what, that tab was like 30 years ago. Oh, it's a screensaver. Quit. Okay. What the hell was I? Okay. Well, you see, that's nice. We've got sort of a breakdown. And this is honestly what companies do, although they usually do. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. A five-state breakdown is actually not that unusual. Some of them go overboard, you know, 10 different states possible, up and down. The one thing that you'll see in my models here is that they will be symmetric so that you have something like a normal distribution, a bell curve. And let's say that the really bad and the incredibly good are both 10% probability occurrences. And then we have 20% blah, 20% meh, So that's a total of 30 and 30, 60. And then there is the sharpest probability of just sort of a standard good economy, $50,000 of revenue. Now, these will have to add up to one, essentially, to exhaust the event space. In other words, we're covering all possibilities. Now, how good is this kind of forecasting? It's as good as you want it to be. You defend your numbers, you get good idea, okay, this is what we think should probably happen in different scenarios, and then you go from there. People can attack your judgment, and you just eat their asses off. Look, this was the way I did it, and I had basis for this, and then we go on from there to talk about more important things. It doesn't really do us a whole lot of good when we've got a bunch of data. We need something that's actionable. What does this tell us about the future? Or at least, excuse me, our expectation of the future. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to want to find the expected value of this, the expected value of sales. And the way we do that is we just take each of these probabilities times the amount that would happen under that scenario. So 0.10 times 30,000 plus 0.20 times 40,000 plus 0.40 times 50,000 plus 0.20 times 60,000 plus 0.10 times 70,000. Now, if this is a symmetric distribution, that will add up to the center value, $50,000. It will add up to the 50 grand if it's symmetric. And I will give you only symmetrics in this class and in tests. And the truth be told, real world, they almost always do symmetrics. Sometimes you want to get fancy and skew it one way or the other, and then it gets to be a lot like work. Most of the time, we just do it with a symmetric distribution. The expected value will come out to be the center value. So don't bust your butt on that. Just know that that's how we get expected values if it's not a symmetric distribution you see sometime. Now, the next one is the one that is the one we care about. It is the one that has to do with volatility. Our first metric, and again, there's going to be a few metrics in this class on volatility. But the first one that we talk about, and it's used out there too, it's not like I'm showing you this and then you wouldn't see it. It's used is the standard deviation sigma. Now, at first, it seems like sigma is one of those real pains in the ass to calculate. But if you watch closely, you can shorten the problem up. First of all, you're going to do a square root of everything. You're going to do all of this under a square root. So if you want to just do the internal calculation, don't forget to do a square root at the end. But what we're going to do is we're going to take each of the actual values that we had as a possibility. For example, we're going to take the probability 0.10 times $30,000 minus $50,000, and we're going to square that. Now, the reason we're squaring it is so that the negative on this side, C30 minus 50 is going to be a negative, doesn't cancel out the positive on the other side. We want volatility to be cumulative. And then we're going to say plus 0.20 times the 40,000 minus the expected value. This 50,000 I keep writing here is your expected value. Plus 0.40 times the 50,000 value in the table minus the expected value squared. And now we're on the upstroke, 0.20 times 60,000 minus 50,000. Square that, and then the 0.10 on the best value, 70,000 less 50,000 quantity squared. Now, you're going to do all of those, add them up, and take the square root. But before you do that, I'm going to ask someone, do you like things like latex and whips and... You're looking at like, what the hell are you asking? Okay, so you're not into the bondage and discipline thing and, you know, make me turn on the candy bar, it's all light. Don't ask me, I just teach. You know, quit it. Okay, you want to avoid work. You want to avoid pain, right? You don't hold up. Anyone want pain? I do. You're not the one. Oh, I do. No, you're not. So here's the thing is, when you're doing math, if you can't find some poor son of a bitch to do it for you, then you've tried to make it as simple for yourself as possible. I want you to look at something. Can you tell me what 50,000 minus 50,000 is? You are an intellectual colossus. I'm not going to even bother with that one. You know what? If I take 40,000 minus 50,000 and square it, I get the same number as 60,000 minus 50,000 when I square it, don't I? So why would I do that negative thing? Negatives are always a downer. They're like real negative things. I guess that's why they call them negative. Okay. Okay. So really, all you have to do is these two and then multiply the result times two to cover the two down here. Because the two down here are the same as the two up here. Just do these two on the top and then times it by two. Don't forget to times it by two, noob, because you'll have to... But really, on these problems, doing standard deviations, it looks like a lot of work. And you should write it down so that when you go home, mom sees it. She's so impressed with you. She bakes you that special apple pie that you like that gives you the trots. Okay. So, hauling that out, I can just pound out. It's a lot faster. And I'm going to show you some shortcuts. We get to something a little later that looks like it's really a lot of calculation, but if you see the tricks in it, it comes down to maybe like just two calculations that take a while, and the rest is real, just instant, if you do it right. For this one, I'm going to go 60,000 minus 50,000 is 10,000, and I'm going to square that, and then I'm going to plus... 70,000 minus 50,000 is 20,000, and I'm going to square that, and I get, whoa, what the hell is it, 100? Is that 500 million? Okay, now I'm going to times it by 2, because I have to cover the two down here that were the symmetrics on the downside. Boy, I wish I hadn't done that. One more zero. Okay, times two. And then I'm just going to take the square root of it. Is that right? That's a wide. Oh, I have to have done something wrong there. Let me do that again. It's 10,000 squared. Oops. Okay. Plus 20,000 squared times 2. Say it. Oh, that's what I did. I didn't do it. Thank you. I was just testing your ass to see if you were watching what I was doing there. Yeah, that's good. You caught it. And I was hoping someone would because I was really getting disappointed that no one had seen the, the hell with all of you. I so suck at arithmetic. Times plus 0.1 times, God, it's hot in here. 20 squared. Okay, equals. Ah, there we go. That makes more sense. That spread looked so ridiculous. Okay, now times 2. Yeah. And I take the square root of that. And if I do that, I get what $10,954.45. It's going to give you a place where you can get the. I was going to bookmark this, but. But I'm not going to be able to. I was going to give you a place where you could do that, where you could see the formula. But I'll be damned if I'm going to get it. Well, it's around page 172 is where you can see this formula in action if you want to see it. But realistically. See this right here? When you're doing these, just round to the nearest dollar, really. I mean, you're already estimating anyway. So just say it's $10,954. I'm just going to show you why this one's kind of a useful little number. You see, if the actual cash flow distribution, expected cash flow distribution, really is a symmetric normal, I know that from 50,000 up positive one standard deviation to down negative one standard deviation, there's a 67% chance that the actual cash flow will occur somewhere in there. That's normal probability theory. I'm not pulling that out of my butt. That's just, if it's a normal distribution, between 50,000 minus 10,954 up to 50,000 plus 10,954, there is a 67% chance that it will fall in that range. It will actually land in that range. I know even more. I know that from $50,000, the expected value, minus down to minus 2 times 10,954 up to 50,000 plus 2 times 10,954, there is a 95% chance that it would fall in that range. And I finally know that from 50,000 minus 3 times the standard deviation up to 50,000 plus 3 times the standard deviation, there's a 99% chance that the result will actually fall in there. You're obviously getting a wider range to get more certainty. But still, you could say in this case, let me do it. Whoops. 50,000 minus 10,954. So from, I know that there's a 67% chance that the actual revenue will fall between $39,046 and $60,954. Whoops. $60,954. 67% chance. I know that. And that's just always going to be the case. From the expected value minus one sigma to the expected value plus one sigma, you have a 67% chance of having it happen, of being in that range. And so I also would know that from 50,000 minus 2 times 10,954, so from $28,092 up to 50,000 plus 2 times 10,954 up to 71,908 dollars, there's a 95% chance that I'll see the cash flow fall in there. See, it's a wider, so you've got more certainty because you're hedging yourself more. And finally, from 50,000 minus 3 times 10,954, which is 17,138, on up to 50,000 plus 3 times 10,954, that's up to 82,862. There's a 99% chance that the cash flow will be somewhere in there. Now, I'll tell you something kind of useful about that. It's like, well, that's a huge range there. Sure, you're going to be 99% sure you're going to be in there. Here's why that can be kind of important, an important concept. Let me roll that up a little bit so you can see a little better. Essentially, in business, there's a place where it's shut down. It's like FTS, out of business, I can't cover my variable costs. That's the end of the game. It's nice to say, all right, we won't be able to be in business at the end of the year if we don't bring to the table at least $15,000 in revenue. So what's the chance that that's going to happen? Well, I can look at this right now. I can say, well, there's less than a 1% chance that's going to happen. Gives us an idea, a little bit of room so we can breathe easy. I can see that, okay, even in worst, 99% of the chance that we're not going to hit $15,000 on the downside. So there's a good 99% chance we're not going to be out of business next year. Now, if someone were to tell me, okay, we're out of business if we don't make $40,000 in revenue next year, what's the chance that that could happen? That begins to make me sweat a little bit because I can say, you know, there's about a 33% chance that we might be out of business next year. See what I'm saying here? It gives us sort of like an idea of our sweat range here. And the first description I gave you, if $15,000 is all we need to stay in business next year, well, there's a 99% chance that we'll stay in business next year. But if you told me that we're out of business if we do not cover $40,000, make $40,000, that puts it a little bit tighter on the downside for me. And I can say, you know, there's a 33% chance that we're going to be belly up next year because there's a 33% chance that we would be outside of this range here. It's a little bit more complex than that, and I don't want to get into too much, but there is practical use for this. But bottom line is, this little animal sigma here is a measure of volatility. There's an adjustment we make to it that makes it more useful. Sigma over the expected value. Now, what this does is this scales it to a percentage. This is called the coefficient of variation. And all it does is it essentially makes it so that we can look at two different companies, two different years, whatever you want to do, and they are comparable because this is essentially just a pure number. It's a percentage. The dollars cancel top and bottom. So in this case, the CV that I had worked out before would have been 10,954 over $50,000. Divided by 50,000 comes out to be 0.2191. It's a percentage. So I can actually compare two different companies' CVs. They're both percentages. And one could be a small company with revenues in the tens of thousands of dollars. The other could be a multi-billion dollar company. And I could still compare them because the CVs don't have dollars in them. They're just percentages, sort of a percentage of volatility. And so these CVs, in the next lecture, you're going to see me milk these CVs for all kinds of different metrics of risk pieces within a company's business, within a company's income statement. I can tease out a coefficient of variation for sales. I can tease out one for gross profit. I can tease out one for net, for operating margin with fixed costs, without fixed costs, all those different things. And at the bottom line, a coefficient of variation for net income. And then I can begin to break apart the different places that risk is happening in a company. Is the biggest risk just sales? Or is the biggest risk the fact that we have a lot of fixed costs that scare us when the volatility gets difficult? Or is our business, is the risk that we are facing mostly because we have these fixed interest payments we have to make? Where is the biggest part of our risk in our business? That's what these CVs do. That's their use, and they are, believe me, they are used out there. Notwithstanding these fancy things with black shoals and all that, this is old school stuff, and it's still used a lot. And I will come back to that in the next lecture. Just keep that on the side burner. Now we have to get down to the last part of this lecture, which is the important part. You ever had to live with other people? Okay. They make noise. Have you ever noticed humans make noise? It just pisses me off that they make noise. I mean, sometimes just human noises, you know, they're taking a piss or they're rummaging for something. Or sometimes they're playing music. And it's music that is, I mean, horrible. It's dubstep. Or it's Rebecca Black or something like that. Or it's Justin Bieber. It's you don't like it. It's noise. And the more you try to ignore it, the more you identify the lyrics. You know, no, I don't want to know. Oh, God, I can hear the lyrics. La, la. You see, that's a problem with noise. It's when it comes from a single source, it's just annoying as hell. But if it comes from more than one source, like 10 different things all at once, it's not quite as annoying because you can't identify individual pieces of it. 30, 50, 1,000, no more can you hear anything that was part of any given piece of it. Now, there's still noise there. There is a noise that exists within a system. We call that systemic. And if we're talking about noise in terms of volatility of sound, volatility of price, volatility of anything, it's systemic risk. Now, that is not the same risk as that stuff that you can identify. The non-systemic risk. the non-systemic noise, the non-systemic volatility. These are two very different sources of risk. One of them you can get rid of. You actually can. You get enough parts of it together and it begins to go away. But the systemic risk, that hum that is underneath everything, that is created when everything cancels everything out, there's still something there. That's systemic risk. Show you what this means. In the business world, we live in this world of removing non-systemic risk and then knowing a lot about what remains. So, for example, woman, remember I told you you were going to die? Okay, I'm going to tell you about your life. Let's start with you. We're going to talk about your health care costs. When you were born, there were some. You were kind of a sickly kid, but you were fairly robust. You know, the doctor spanked you and you slugged the doctor. So they said, okay, this kid's going to be very low cost. And your costs, there were a couple of little bouts when you were in your toddler years. And then there was that incident where you got hit by the car. And then they went down. And then you had that childhood illness. But then you got pretty healthy and you got into school. You had some vaccines you had to take. And then later you broke a leg. But then you were fairly healthy and you had a few ups and downs. Then you got really bad acne, so they had to pay for some special medicine and in your teen years. And then your health care costs actually fell. You were beginning to develop your herd immunities and you felt pretty good about yourself year to year. Then you get into your later 20s and you begin to feel a few creaks and you go to the doctor more. By the time you're in your mid-30s, you're beginning to have more problems. And then about 40, you get diabetes and then cancer and then rheumatoid arthritis and then mental illness. Oh, sorry. You get to your golden years and you're pretty healthy. You have a few kidney things and you live with problems in your heart disease and then your asthma and then you die. There's your life. And you didn't have to pay a fortune teller. Volatility. I don't know when you're going to break that leg. I don't know when the acne is going to pop out on your face. I don't know when you're going to start suffering mental problems. Okay? I don't know when you're going to have those tubes put in you so that you can, you know, go to the bathroom properly. I don't know. But I do know that things are going to happen. There's going to be volatility. Not every year, not every day, not every decade is your cost of healthcare going to be the same. Now, I'm going to go to you. You look like a strapping stud. You were born healthy, looked damn good, but they found out right away that there were some pretty serious problems. Gender identification was a little tricky. So they assigned one. It worked out. You are so damn strange. Anyway, and then you were fairly healthy, but you had a little problem in your early years. And you had a couple of major childhood illnesses. But then you got really healthy. And your puberty was after hers, so the acne didn't develop until you were 18. And it was a doozy. Jeez, oh my God, you were. And then you got into athletics so that you would have a flat stomach because you still hadn't gotten married and you had to look good still. Didn't do any work. And then you hurt yourself pretty badly. You tore a groin muscle. But But then you got healthy again. Then you started getting cholesterol because you were eating too many damn fatty foods. And then you got that prostate thing that really, really scared people who saw you. And then you got healthy. And then you got towards your older years and you started having some problems with different things. Your bowels acted up a lot. And then you got cancer, heart disease, kidney failure. You got better for a while, but you had all these heart medications all the time and all this. And then you died. Before her, men die before women on average. That should piss you off too. But I want you to notice something about these. Those were not perfectly correlated patterns. So if I put those two patterns together, the combination would not have as much volatility as the individual patterns would. It would not. Because there would be, unless they were perfectly correlated, they would partially cancel each other out. See how there were ups for you that were downs for her, downs for you that were ups for her? Now, they weren't perfect, but they were partial cancellations. Now, if I put other people, suppose that I bring kids into this system, young people who would be healthy in the years when you were getting really sick and having high expenses, they would cancel it out even more. You'd be canceling in your young years the people before you. If I accumulated thousands and thousands of people like this, just adding them up to a total amount of cost per year, I would see something amazing. The cost would have almost no volatility. It would still have a cost, but it would not have hardly any volatility. It would still have a little bit, but the vast majority of this volatility would be gone from it. And all that would be left would be a systemic risk, which would be highly predictable. So if every one of you joined into an insurance pool, I would know pretty much what premium to charge that would cover all of my costs and give me a profit. The non-systemic risks would cancel each other out. And all that would be left underneath would be a hum of the system itself, of people getting sick, people being well, and all of that. It's the same that's true with stocks. Every stock that you will buy has volatility. Most of that volatility would be canceled out if you had other stocks in your portfolio. The volatility, and I'm going to write it this way. Risk on the vertical axis, number of different stocks on the horizontal axis. With one stock, you have got ungodly amounts of volatility, price volatility. With two stocks, you're still pretty bad off. But as you start to add more and more stocks, the volatility falls. And it falls asymptotically toward a level that we call the systemic risk of the system. Now, if you wanted to talk about the perfectly diversified portfolio, you're talking about something that cannot be attained. It would be actually every stock in the economy in the weight of that company's capitalization to the overall cap of the economy. I mean, you can't do it. I mean, that would just be, it's just physically impossible. But here's the interesting thing. By the time you get to like 30 stocks, you got almost all of that non-systemic risk out. You've shaken it out. 30 stocks, and I mean, you can even go further than that. Talk to you about two different financial instruments. One would be mutual funds. Now, mutual funds, essentially, the mutual fund manager buys a portfolio, a diversified portfolio of stocks. It might be a very risky portfolio, a very low risk, a lot of stocks that are risky, a lot of stocks that are safe, whatever. Buys a portfolio that's diversified, and then you buy into the mutual fund. So essentially, you're participating in that vast diversification simply by owning a piece of the mutual fund. That is one way that you can achieve huge diversification without having to go to the extent of buying 30 stocks. Another one are ETFs. They actually are stocks, like stocks, except that they are backed by a portfolio like the Standard & Poor's 500. So when you buy a share of this ETF stock, you're buying actually a piece of a massively diversified portfolio like the Standard & Poor's 500. Here's the upside and here's the downside. With mutual funds, there are usually either low load or no load funds. You get in there, there's no transactions charge. But you can shift your portfolio, you can shift your mutual fund. Well, this one's a little risky, I want to go to something a little safer, or this one's kind of a little safer, I want to go to something a little riskier. You can't do that all the time. You have windows during the year, four windows during the year, something like that. With the ETFs, you can do it anytime you want. It's a stock. You can shift anytime you want. The downside of that is, of course, transactions cost. You're going to pay broker's fee every time you shift. However, in either case, you're buying diversification. And another question would be, although I personally think the E's are very cool animals, the question is, why would you be shifting? Why do you want to shift so much? Once you have established your portfolio and you have reasonable assurance that it's diversified, the only shifts that you should be making are in a fundamental change in your judgment about the economy or in a fundamental change in where you are in your life. You won't always be a young, risk-taking hotshot. Someday you'll be old and you'll be looking for your check in the mail. Okay? So you would make portfolio adjustments based upon that in your life. But other than that, shifting yourself around a lot isn't a good idea, just because why would you be doing it? So that would kind of favor the mutual funds. But at the same time, if you want that flexibility with the higher transactions costs, then the E's are much better stuff for you. Okay, here's where the bottom line of this part. Look, you buy one stock, it's going to have a massive amount of non-systemic risk and a little bit of, it's going to have a massive amount of non-systemic risk, and it's going to have a little bit of systemic risk. Now, this massive amount of non-systemic risk, that is what we call diversifiable risk. It can be removed by simply diversifying. The markets are not going to reward you for taking on something that is completely unnecessary. Markets have no sentimentality whatsoever. They are not going to give you a damn dime for taking a risk that you don't have to. You're just taking it because you don't want to diversify. The only reward you should expect from a market is the reward for bearing systemic risk, for the non-diversifiable risk. That's the only place part you should expect a reward for. So here's the deal. And I can guarantee you, if you hear on the TV or on one of these financial guru programs, you should buy this stock, that's when you turn off the television. You shut his pie hole because he can't control himself. No, why are you buying a single stock? Are you out of your mind? You're bearing massive amounts of risk that the market isn't going to reward you for. Okay, well, suppose I buy that as part of a diversified portfolio. You tell me how it fits into that diversified portfolio, what its risk is versus your portfolio's risk, how it fits with your risk preferences. Perhaps we'll talk. But simply buying a stock and then thinking you're going to get rewarded for all that risk you're taking, you're not going to get any reward at all for most of that risk. Even if you bought a Microsoft. Microsoft has an extraordinary amount of price volatility. It really does. You measure the sigma. It's a lot of volatility. But most of it is irrelevant volatility because it's volatility that you can get rid of if you've got Microsoft in a well-diversified portfolio. That's the whole thing about the market's ways. They don't reward for naked, stupid risk. Back in the day, we really loved day traders. We just loved those people who did that. Because you know why we loved them? We loved their money. We took it from them because they were dumbasses. I saw a guy, he bought one stock and he made $1 million, and I will show you 100,000 that I took for a ride, and I punished their asses, and then they went back to their day jobs and they were glad they were there. That's how it works. We will tell you about the person. He bought one stock. He bought 1,000 shares of one stock, and he made a huge amount of money. Big freaking deal. Because a whole lot, hundreds of thousands of people did the same kinds of things. They lost their shirts. They aren't on TV bragging, yeah, I bought that one stock, and I got my ass kicked. No, they're not going to do that. So you're going to get this bias. And these gurus on TV who tell you, buy a stock, don't listen to them unless you hear them say, as part of a well-diversified portfolio. And if you've got a well-diversified portfolio, the next question I say is, well, why are you buying individual stocks? Why aren't you just buying into an E or a mutual? Why are you doing it yourself? Is it a macho thing? If it is, that's cool. Do you like looking at computer screens and watching the price go up and down and shitting your pants every time the price goes down through the floor? That's your thing. You got the diapers, I've got the stocks. But at this, gotta forgive me, this is how I talk to investors who come to me and want to know, well, I heard about this stock. I talk to them like this. And by the time I'm finished with them, they usually think I'm just a jerk and they go out and buy it anyway and they get their butts kicked. So anyway, but here's the deal. Again, there is this massive amount of diversifiable risk. You don't get rewarded. You should not expect a reward for it. And then there is this underlying hum of non-diversifiable risk. That's the risk that we look at in finance. How is that? How do we measure the non-diversifiable risk? How do we use that measure? How do we connect that measure of non-diversifiable risk with the expected return that is commensurate with it? That's the big one. We expect a return for bearing risk. You are not going to take a risk unless you expect something out of it, okay? You really don't. Well, maybe, I don't know, do you? Would you take a risk if there was nothing in it for you? Oh, I'm glad for that. Do you see that movie, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? She was a crazy girl. I mean, she carved tattoos into guys. But here's the deal. Okay, there obviously, you if you dated her, you would expect something happy out of it, right? Have you ever eaten a hot food? Have you ever eaten a hot sauce of any kind? Do you like hot spicy foods?
Yeah.
Okay, I do too. You know what a boot jalolokai pepper is?
I never heard of it.
It's called a ghost pepper.
Right.
They're on YouTube. I didn't believe it, so I tried a bit of one. You know what? It was not worth the expected return. It was not worth the risk. I'll tell you what, I mean flesh coming off your mouth, and then you kept saying, I did not swallow any of that pepper. I did not. And about 2 hours later, yeah, you did. Might want to bring in the TV to the bathroom, in your laptop. You might want to bring the radio in too. Look, we don't take risk for nothing. We take it because we expect a return. Not a guarantee. There's no guarantee in this life. But we expect a return. So the bottom line is that if we are measuring risk, the whole point of measuring risk is so that we can answer the question, what is the expected return commensurate with that risk? But remember, risk is not just risk. It is non-diversifiable risk because no one is going to give you anything, and you should not expect anything for bearing stupid risk, risk that you don't have to bear. Markets aren't going to do it for you. No one's going to do it. So the bottom line is that what we are aiming at in the next lecture is a connector between a measure of risk that's non-diversifiable and what we can expect from it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.